Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
Please be joined now. Please try that again, Tavis. Please to be joined now. Bye. I'm so excited to talk to him. The Intercept's DC Bureau Chief, Ryan Grimm, who is also a host of the podcast Deconstructed. Ryan, good to have you back. How are you, sir?
Great to be here. How you doing?
Man, if I complained, I'd be an ingrate. But I am troubled by these times that we find ourselves in. Just had a fascinating conversation, insightful conversation with Phyllis Bennis about what happened, what is happening in the Middle East. I want to make the most of the time I have with you. I don't need to color this much more for you. I just read the piece out now in The Intercept about this notion of the spin that we continue to get, including from John Kirby yesterday on Meet the Press, that we are not as yet in a wider war and hope not to get into one. Y'all ain't buying that at The Intercept, are you?
I mean, does this look like a wider war to you? Let's see, who's involved in the war right now? Iran, France, UK, US, Israel, Yemen, Palestine, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey playing a little go-between between Iran and the U.S. That feels like a pretty wide war to me. I don't know about you, though.
Why then, I'm not naive in asking this, why then does the Biden administration keep spinning it this way?
Well, I think nobody wants a wider war. And so if they can speak it into existence, then everybody would be happy. Now, I will take a rare opportunity to give Biden a little bit of credit for at least so far fending off an Israeli response, because there was a moment, as the Iran attack was unfolding, where the far right in Israel was promising that, their immediate response was going to be unprecedented in its ferocity, and it was going to, mark the date as one that would go down in history for the, cataclysmic and catastrophic response that they would be delivering. Biden did get on the phone with Netanyahu and told him, take the win. Like, you knocked everything out of the sky, take the win. And the U.S. will not be supporting, an offensive attack against Iran, and they have not launched one yet. So, we can take some, maybe some small victories there, because, Iran was responding to its own, consulate getting hit in Damascus, and Iran has said, we're done with this. Like, we consider this over. There's been a back, there's been a forth, and we're done. So now, we could get what the Biden administration wants, which is not a regional war, if everybody just, dials it back from here.
Yep. So I said moments ago, I repeat again, that I've never seen evidence of this particular prime minister, Bibi Netanyahu, taking the win. I love the phrase, take the win. But there's no evidence that Bibi believes in taking the win, number one. And as I said again moments ago in this conversation with Phyllis Bennis, that there is this thought that Israel can never. I've been to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. Been there a couple of times, and it's a beautiful museum. It's powerful. It's arresting when you walk through it, and when you leave in that final hallway, that final gallery, there's a huge sign that says "Never again, never again." And it's arresting when you actually see that and you walk through that museum. And part of that never again is not allowing people to hit you and to not respond. So there's some who believe there's no such thing as Israel in this instance or any other just taking the win, unless and until they wipe out Hamas, which I think is impossible. But they don't believe in taking the win. They cannot allow history to record that any country hit them with over 300 weapons of destruction, and that they did not respond. So I am not of the mindset yet, I want to be, that Bibi is going to take the win, Ryan Grimm.
Right. Now, the good news is that the kind of center-to-center right commentariat, the establishment commentariat in Israel over the last day or so, has been taking a more cautious approach. The far right in Israel is saying exactly what you're saying there, that we need a devastating response, to this attack and wipe Iran off the face of the earth. But voices that often are calling for aggressive action are being much more cautious. The Iran attack, that scene in Austin Powers where he's on the steamroller and there's a security guard who's like, no, like th- that was the Iran attack. Like, you know, they gave 72 hours heads up to the United States about the precise moment that they were going to launch this. And the U.S. sent back a signal that, you know, this attack better be within particular confines or we're going to be, you know, very upset. And then they send these very slow-moving drones over the course of hours. It really was Austin Powers and the steamroller, and gave the security guard the chance to actually, you know, step aside. You know, he didn't in the movie, and that's what made that funny. But in this case, they had the opportunity. So there is plenty of room, you know, for the IDF to say, look at how, you know, big and bad our military is with the help of, you know, Jordan and the U.S., and U.K. and France. We knocked all of this stuff out of the sky and then just take the win. But the problem, as you said, is not only, you know, psychological, but it's also, you know, the moment that this war ends, such as an ending could look like, you know, given the fact that Gaza is now complete rubble, Netanyahu is facing the end of his political career. He's facing these corruption charges, and we have this bizarre situation where the guy's personal incentive is to hang on to power as long as he possibly can to escape these future corruption charges from going forward. And so it's in his personal interests just to keep this war going forever. It's also in the military's broad interest because they don't want a reckoning either with October 7th. They had a complete collapse on that day, total failure on their part. So they want that to be as far in the rearview mirror as possible.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is just to keep this war going and expand it.
Yeah. In that sense, Bibi Netanyahu reminds you of somebody here stateside who's doing what he can to hold on to power, to stave off that day that is coming, even though it may be in the distance. He's inexorably hurling toward that day where he has to have a reckoning with all the allegations, all the charges, all the indictments against him. So there's not much difference in some respect between Bibi Netanyahu and some guy named Donald Trump, who we'll talk about here in just a moment. But I'm glad you raised that, because this is not often raised in conversation. And leave it to Ron Grimm of The Intercept to raise it, put it front and center, and make us wrestle with it. So let's go. It is, and I've said it before on this program, of course, but it is more than troubling, beyond troubling to me, that in part, which I think this is inarguable, and you say it brilliantly and eloquently, it's inarguable that part of the reason why we are still in this is because of one man's personal political ambitions. And that is sick to me.
Yeah, it's really hard to talk about because it's so sick. You don't hear it talked about a lot in the media, although pretty much every commentator who follows this closely acknowledges it as a fundamental kind of background reality of this situation. And if you're only following it casually, right, you won't see it talked about in the news. But it is a fact that, you know, he's facing these corruption charges. If people remember the protests that were going on for about a year before this broke out, that was about this judicial reform that Netanyahu was doing, which was also related, critics in Israel said, to his own personal corruption charges. You know, it was a way to put the courts, you know, under the thumb of the political wing of the government. And so, yes, you have this insane situation where if it ends, it's good for the world. It's good for everyone, except it's bad for one guy. And I wish that there was some way that the U.S. could say, you know what? We'll give asylum to Netanyahu, and he can have safe passage to Florida, play golf, like live out his retirement. He's not gonna rot in an Israeli jail, but he's not gonna be prime minister anymore, and this war is gonna end. Like, I think that would be, that might not serve the interests of the particular justice that is probably due to Netanyahu in this corruption case, and then also, you know, more generally around what's going on in Gaza. Yeah. But if it ends the war, then I think people would take that win.
Yeah, I'm thinking of all the protests he'd be subjected to every time he shows up anywhere in Florida or anyplace else, for all the thousands of folk he killed in this war. I don't imagine that I'm not sure the U.S. is where he'd want to be. I'm not sure any place in the world is where he'd want to be, because I can't imagine he would not be protested time and time again trying to take cover in some other country. But it's fascinating to think about. When we come forward, speaking of the aforementioned Donald Trump, his first trial, day one, rather, of this particular trial is underway in Manhattan. We'll talk to Ron Grimm about it on Tavis Smiley.
From the Mert Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. He's rooting for everybody black.
Everybody black.
More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now. Right now.
More of the Intercept's D.C. Bureau Chief Ron Grimm coming your way right now. And so it's finally happened. Donald Trump is on trial in Manhattan. He did everything he could to delay this case. That day that shall come has come. He is the first former president to be criminally prosecuted. Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, is accusing Trump, as you know, of falsifying business records in the first degree, 34 felony counts, all of which are tied to the former president's role in these hush money payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels. So, Ryan, many people thought this day might not ever come, at least not soon enough to get a conviction before November. This may be the only one of these cases that actually gets into trial with some sort of verdict before November. But what say you about this that many people regard as the weakest of these cases? And yet, every time I hear somebody say that, I think of Al Capone. They got him on tax evasion, but I digress. Right. Yeah.
The problem is, yes, it's a strong case to me in the sense that he did the thing. It's pretty well laid out that he did all the things that are alleging here. It's weakest in the sense that, you know, it's very unlikely that this kind of a case would lead to actual jail time. Now, he might, get himself put in jail by running his mouth at the trial. That's still possible, but that's a different kind of trial. But did you see the thing where he apparently fell asleep in the courtroom today?
Yeah, I read that piece.
I mean, you know, some of these, you know, on the one hand, he's it's a historic moment, the former a former president in a criminal trial. On the other hand, you know, a lot of these procedural things can get pretty boring, but it does seem like, you know, according to Maggie Haberman over at the New York Times, he was who wrote a, you know, great biography of him and knows him better than anybody, pretty much. He was slack jawed and his head bobbing up and down. So maybe that's the approach the attorney suggested he take to avoid, getting any more contempt citations or winding up in jail. Just sleep through this, Donald. And, you know, we'll wake you up. We'll wake you up if we need you.
Yeah. Ultimately, does it matter? I've asked this question of others, but not of Ryan Grimm. Does it matter in this case, particularly if it doesn't lead to jail time? And I suspect it won't. But does it matter if he loses this case, if he's found guilty? I mean, ultimately, to his voters, to anybody prepared to vote for Donald Trump right now, who's aware of everything he's up against, does it really matter in the end?
It's hard to see how it does. You know, you've got polls out there that will say that have people saying that if he is convicted, that there's a certain portion that go from supporting him to opposing him. I'm curious for your take. I don't really believe those polls. I think those are people who feel like that's what they're supposed to say.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when people are taking a poll, they feel like it's a pop quiz and they're answering like how the pollster thinks they're supposed to answer. And so they say, well, what if he's convicted of a felony? There's some portion of people who are going to be like, well, I think the right answer there is that, of course, I wouldn't support a guy who's a convicted felon. But once he's a convicted felon, he's not in prison and he's still Donald Trump. And let's say this is a person who still hates Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Then I could, you know, then it's hard to see them moving away from him on that. You know, the same thing with, you know, he got the civil trial, found him guilty of sexual assault. And, you know, that hasn't pushed his numbers underneath Biden.
No, you asked a question. I'll respond to you right quick before we move forward with our final conversation in this hour. They may be lying, to your point, when they tell the pollster that, because they're expected to say that. You and I agree in that regard. But pardon my English, but even if they ain't lying, Joe Biden ain't the answer to the prayer for them. So even if they're telling the truth, it's not like they're going to vote for Joe Biden under any condition or any circumstance. So I digress. Our remaining moments with Ryan Grimm will be come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Unapologetically black. Black. You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
More honesty than you can handle.
More empowerment than you can imagine.
You're tuned in to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and the Intercept's Ryan Grimm. 3 minutes left in this conversation. One final point I think I want to get to with Ryan. So Ryan, Geraldo Rivera, who I've known for years, a friend of mine, but he and I got into it the other night on News Nation. He was hosting on the other night. Must have been whatever, it was Wednesday, Thursday last week. And we got into it. There are clips that are floating all around the internet of he and I kind of, again, getting at it. Because he suggested on the occasion of the death of O.J. Simpson, he went back 30 years ago and basically made this same argument that because the jury was overwhelmingly black, there was no way that that they were ever going to convict O.J. He goes on to say that if there had been videotape of O.J. killing these two people, these black folk on the jury would not have convicted O.J. Simpson. So as you can imagine, I was not standing for it. I wasn't having it. And we got into it. And my point was, how dare you suggest that black folk cannot sit on juries, listen to evidence, make informed and impartial decisions. Black folk convict people every day in this country on juries. Furthermore, we're the most forgiving people on the planet. When y'all come into black churches like Mother Emanuel or go into supermarkets like in Buffalo and kill us, many black folk forgive you before you've even asked for forgiveness. So we got into it. But I raise that because he then pivoted from the OJ thing to the Donald Trump case and made the point that because it's in Manhattan and because that jury, you know where I'm going now, is going to be mostly black and brown. Geraldo argues it's going to be a black and brown jury. There's no way that Donald Trump can get a fair trial, as if these folk can't look at the evidence that appears to be overwhelming brought by Alvin Bragg, that he did what he's alleged to have done, and we'll hear testimony from Michael Cohen. But Geraldo already starts to advance the argument that I suspect we're going to hear from Donald Trump when he loses this case, that it's these black folk and brown folk that did him in. Your thoughts?
You've already seen his team kind of preview that argument with juries in both D.C. and New York. Like, for them, they don't count. Those are not his peers, and they can't be trusted to be impartial. This is a talking point on the right that is at the very top of the list, and you're absolutely gonna see it circulating, with ferocity.
Yep. It's going to be fascinating because on the one end, Donald Trump has got pictures, fake AI pictures, but pictures nonetheless of him hugging and loving on black people. And he keeps bragging about how well he's doing with black people. And yet watch his people while he's
right
out of one side of the mouth. He's telling black people he's the best thing for them. But the minute he loses this case, he's going to blame black people for his fate. So how he squares those two things, I have no idea, but get ready for it. You heard it here first from Ryan Grimm and Tavis Smiley. He is the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. His name is Ryan Grimm. Always honored to have him on this program. Ryan, thanks for your insights, my friend. All the best to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When we come forward, Alice Randall on Tavis Smiley.